So, the Ten Commandments tonight, what are the ground rules, is the subject heading I've been given. It reminds me of an interesting conversation that I had a few years ago now with a friend who's an atheist. And at one point in the conversation I said, well, you know, Christianity is not so much about rules, it's about a relationship with Jesus Christ specifically. Have you ever heard that phrase before? We've probably all said it to people. Christianity is not so much about rules, it's about a relationship. But then he came straight back at me and said, okay, tell me what that's like. And I have to say, I'm ashamed to say it, at that point I was a bit stumped. Like, what do you say? What's that? Tell me what that's like. What's a relationship with God actually like? What's it actually like knowing God? What difference would it make to me if I was in a relationship with God, James? And so I did tell him some stuff. We'll call him Mark. His name's not actually Mark, but we'll call him Mark, this chap. I told him some things about prayer and my attitude to life, hope for the future, that sort of thing, all of which I believe. But really, I sort of knew he'd got me. I thought, I need to really go back and consider what I really think about this. And I think he probably knew it too. And I've kept thinking about it ever since. What does it really mean to be in a relationship with God? What does it really mean to know Jesus Christ? What difference does it make? And, you know, I think the Israelites, the children of Israel, might have had a very similar question after the Exodus rescue at this point in the story, as we're coming to the Ten Commandments. I'm aware there'd be some pretty big differences in the way they'd phrase the question. They haven't heard of Jesus. That's the big difference. But just think about their situation. They've just been rescued from slavery in Egypt, spectacularly. Plagues, Passover, Red Sea, drowning the Egyptian cavalry. And now they're arriving at Mount Sinai in the wilderness. And God says something in chapter 19. I'll read it out to you. Chapter 19, verse 4, very well-known verses. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. You shall be my treasured possession. Now that sounds an awful lot to me, like God is saying, I want to have an intimate relationship with you. But again, what does that mean? The Israelites might well have been wondering that. What does it mean to be God's treasured possession, to know him? They're about to find out. And it's pretty dramatic. So a couple of verses later in chapter 19, there are thunders and lightning, a thick cloud on the mountain. It says there's a very loud trumpet blast so that all the Israelites trembled. Can you imagine that? It then goes on, Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. So this terrifying, awesome God speaks audibly from the smoke and the darkness, and he says the Ten Commandments. And I know that the Ten Commandments, you might not think that's the best place to go to find out what it means to be in relationship. This is the classic rules passage in the whole Bible, isn't it? Well, actually, I think they are far, far more than rules. It's time to find out what it means for the Israelites and for us to be in relationship with God. So, if you're open already on page 61 to Exodus 20, I'm going to read out the Ten Commandments, so that's verses 1 to 17, and then we'll get into them. Exodus 20, verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honour your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbour. You shall not covet your neighbour's house. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbour's. Okay. Now, as Luke already mentioned, the Ten Commandments, they're fairly well known. That's an understatement, isn't it? Many of us have been taught them before. Lots of us will have taught them ourselves before to children or other people. And who knows, maybe some of you have got them memorized back to front. So I'm just aware that I should probably set out what my aim is this evening, given that I, in some sense, will be preaching to the choir. My aim for the evening, I'm not going to go into each one of the commandments in detail. And also, this isn't going to be the sort of sermon where you're supposed to go away and do anything or not doing anything in particular. It's not that kind of sermon. So, for example, I'm not going to be getting into whether we here should observe the Sabbath or not. I'm sorry if that's the kind of sermon you were looking for tonight. Instead, what my aim is that we soak in the overall picture of the Ten Commandments, the picture of what it means to be in relationship with God, and not just soak in it, but enjoy it and wonder at it. Because I think, and I hope that you'll agree with me by the end, it's a pretty stunning picture that's painted before us. We'll start with the first four commandments, and then we'll take the other six after that. So, the first four commandments. You could say that these are the vertical ones. People sometimes divide them like that. Vertical as in between us and God, the ones that deal directly with God. And 5 to 10 are the horizontal ones. So in these first four, well, what jumps out to me here, if you're going to be in relationship with God, then you have to be devoted to God himself. Devoted to God himself. That probably sounds blindingly obvious, doesn't it? I'm using the word himself, though, quite specifically. You have to be devoted to God himself, as in God as he actually is. Let me read out the first couple of commandments again, so verse 3 to 6. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And it goes on. The first commandment, I think that's straightforward. No other gods, just Yahweh, the true God. The second one, though, what does that mean? At face value, it's saying that God's people must not make carved images of anything. So no statues that they then bow down and worship. Icons, you might call them. I, for a long time, thought that this was basically saying the same thing as the first commandment. You know, just another way of saying, don't have any other gods before me. You can't make images of those other gods either. Actually, they're not the same. They are subtly different, and it's an important difference. And let me just show you that. So if you look at the second commandment again, beginning in verse 4, it never actually says the word gods or idols. In fact, it never says what you're making an image of at all. It just says, don't make an image of anything. Second point about this, it follows straight after the first commandment, and I think in general it's pretty safe to say that God knows what he's doing when he speaks. He's not going to say the same thing twice for no reason. So instead, I think that the second commandment assumes that you've already taken the first one into account and is adding something additional on top of that. As in, now that you've put away your false gods, make sure you don't make any images that you worship. But if you don't have any false gods, then what are these images going to be of? God is saying, don't make an image of me. Not me, God. Saying, don't make an image of me. So you've got rid of your false gods, excellent. But now that you're worshipping me, the true God, don't try to represent me in any kind of statue or icon or carving or image. Don't represent me with something that you might find in the sky or the land or the sea. Don't make an image of me. And actually, if you know the story, which most of us do, this is the very thing that Israel gets wrong a few chapters later. You remember with the golden calf they make? They call that statue Yahweh, the God who brought us up out of the land of Egypt. So I think the second commandment is, do you know the story of Aladdin with the genie and the lamp? I'm sure we all know versions of it. Aladdin discovers this all-powerful being bottled up inside a lamp at the beck and call of the master of the lamp, which is Aladdin. Hooray for him. But you can't bottle up God. So with this second commandment, God's been really straight. There is no figure or form of anything in creation, no human art or human concept of any kind that can fully describe me. Don't try to bottle me up like some genie. You'll end up with something that is so much less than I am. So what picture do these first and second commandments paint for us? God wants the people he's in relationship with to put aside all other gods and idols and to be devoted to him himself as he really is. Not a statue of him, not a picture, not some imitation of him, not a human idea of him. I like to think of God as ... Not a partial version of him. Well, I'll have those bits of God, but not those. No, God himself, as he really is, incomparable, uncontainable, like we were just singing, immortal, invisible, God only wise. The I am, the God who is speaking out of the earthquake and the fire and the darkness as he issues these commands. Quite weighty stuff, I think, already, just commandment two. So maybe in that conversation with my friend Mark, the atheist, perhaps I should have said something like, well, do you want to know what it's like to have a relationship with God, Mark? Well, it's not like any other relationship, because this is God. He's just like no one else. He's completely incomparable. He's way beyond the limits of what you could understand or what I could understand. And actually, Mark, if you want to get specific, that's the reason why I read the Bible, actually. I spend loads of time reading the Bible and thinking about it, because naturally I come to this relationship with God with all sorts of preconceived ideas about what he's like that are just completely balmy. So it's really important that I'm not in relationship with some made-up version of God that I think is God. So I read the Bible not because I have to, but because I want to know the God I'm in relationship with better. Let's keep building the picture, shall we? Now, Commandments 3 and 4, still in the first four, Commandments 3 and 4 move us into a slightly different area. What does it mean to know God? Well, so far we've sort of had the negative side. No false gods, no wrong versions of God. Okay, if that's what it doesn't look like, then what does it look like? What's the relationship actually going to be like, positively, between man and God? And that is where the third and fourth commandments take us. Let me put that to you as a question, actually. I think it's quite an interesting one. How do you think you would answer it if you didn't know Commandments 3 and 4, perhaps? What positively is the relationship between man and God like, or meant to be like? Or how might people that you know answer it? Let's have a think about that. The man on the street. I think there's something or a kind of thing that most people would instinctively say, and this isn't necessarily wrong, in terms of how people might think that God would want us to relate to him. I think most people would have an answer along the lines of, if there is a God, he must want us to fear him. That makes sense. Respect him, yeah. Give him his due praise and worship and honor. Be in awe of him, perhaps. Because he's God, I suppose, and potentially love him, depending on what he's like, potentially love him. I think most people, if you ask people on the street, would say that kind of answer, or one of those options. We give him those kind of things, respect, fear, awe, love, perhaps. And I'm not saying that's a bad instinct, I think those things are all right. And that's actually exactly where the third commandment takes things. So, third commandment, if you have a look at it, verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. So, face value, don't speak about God casually. This is respect, isn't it? But I think it applies to other areas beyond speech as well. Speech is the first thing it applies to, but it continues. Your thinking about God, your attitude towards him, respect. Take him as seriously as you should do. And this makes sense, this is right, this is intuitive. After all, it's God that we're talking about. This is the creator, the God of the plagues and Mount Sinai. But if that's all that God said about how we should relate to him, I think it could still end up being a bit of a distant relationship. Don't you think? We give those kind of things to God, or respect, etc. Beyond that, are we basically meant to leave him a bit alone? You know, like we live over here in this area and God's over here, and sometimes we come over and give him our due respect. Maybe at best the kind of way you might relate to a great politician, or a king in a country, something like that. I think this is why the fourth commandment is so revolutionary. The Sabbath. I think the more I've thought about this, it takes it in such an unexpected direction. Let me read the Sabbath to you. I'll read all of it, verses 8 to 11. It's very unexpected. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your livestock, or the sojourner who's within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. What got me thinking with this at first was the fact that it doesn't start, you shall not. It's the first commandment that's actually positive at the beginning rather than a negative. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. I thought, that's interesting. And, okay, well, what does that mean to remember the Sabbath day? Well, it explains no one can do any work. Makes sense, that's what Sabbath means. It means rest. Even the livestock, which I thought was quite fun. Give your cow a day off. But then there's this really, really fascinating connection in verse 11. There's a link made between the Sabbath and God and the work of creation when he made the universe and the world. And confession, I haven't pinned this down yet. It's something that I think you can think about and find that you still haven't really nailed it. And that's been my experience preparing here. Who knows, perhaps it's meant to be that way. But anyway, I'll give you my best shot as to what I think this command is about. So when God made the world, that's what it's referring to in verse 11. When God made the world, we'll be familiar with this. He made the world in 6 days. He finished the work of creating after the sixth day. And on the seventh day, I'll quote to you from Genesis 2 what it says on the seventh day. God rested from all his work that he had done. He blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. Now, the funny thing with that seventh day, this day of rest, is it doesn't end in Genesis 2. All of the other 6 days of creation end with this same phrase, and there was evening as the, and there was morning, the fourth day or the fifth day. Evening, morning, so they end. But the seventh day, I just read it to you, there's no neat ending. It's like this rest of the seventh day just keeps on going indefinitely. Now, you do still get day and night happening, you do get literal days, but there's this idea that all of those days subsequently are part of this big rest day. And there's a sense that when you read it, well, as far as I can tell, the idea with the seventh day of creation is the whole purpose of creation was for this rest. That was the end goal. The 6 days were just a means to an end, and the seventh day was that end. The point of God creating, the reason that he made the universe and us, everything else that's here, is so that God and humanity and creation could all enjoy this rest together. Now, that rest didn't carry on very long, did it? We know that one chapter later in Genesis 3, Satan, temptation, sin, fall. And then it's anything but rest from that point onwards, isn't it? But now we arrive at Mount Sinai, and we hear the fourth commandment. It's like God is saying, I want that time back, that blissful time of rest with you in the garden. I want it back. The time when in Eden we enjoyed each other's company, truly. The time that was the way I made things to be. It's what you were created for, and I want it back again. Is it okay to use a marriage analogy at this point? I think, actually, for most of Exodus, particularly from this point onwards, the marriage analogy is the best one I can think of. It's certainly in the way that God talks about the children of Israel. And I think that's the way the rest of the Bible looks back on this at points as well. So here's the analogy. Before a couple gets married, they're courting or dating, and they just love spending time together, right? At least, hopefully. They can't get enough of talking and just being in each other's company. It doesn't matter what they're doing. But then after a few years of marriage, you start to realize that just because you live together and do lots of stuff together, that doesn't necessarily mean you're spending time together, does it? Do you know what I mean? Quality time. Really engaging with each other. I think a fair paraphrase then of the fourth commandment is something like, come and spend quality time with me. Take time off from doing other stuff. Have some space apart from the grind and the normality of everyday life to enjoy time with me, your creator. God's saying, I do actually value your company. I want you to spend time with me. It's what I made you for. And this theme of rest with God, it's not unique just to Genesis and Exodus. It comes up a lot in the Bible. And we know that God ultimately descends to earth again, not in fire and darkness, but in the person of Jesus Christ. And do you remember what he says? Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. That's Matthew 11:28. I'm sure you know that. And just before we move on into the second half of the commandments, The thing that's really excited me here this week, as I've been thinking about it, is it's how the fourth commandment really changes the way that you hear the second commandment. Let me explain that. So the second commandment is very exclusive, isn't it? Worship no other gods and make sure it really is me that you're worshipping, not some version of me that you've cooked up. And on its own, that commandment is absolutely fair. It's absolutely right. We can definitely say that. But it's still sort of particular. Pernickety, is that a word? The spell check seemed to recognize it. But if you add in Sabbath, I just think this is amazing. The reason that it has to be God himself that you're worshipping, not some image of him, is because God himself wants your company. It really matters to him that you're spending time with the real him, not a rubbish imitation. In other words, God cares that this relationship is authentic. Again, to me, it sounds quite a lot like a marriage relationship. To make it work, this is so obvious, but you need your spouse to interact with the real you, not some caricatured version of you that they've developed over the years. I mean, actually, you could apply that to any kind of relationship, couldn't you? It's horrid when somebody doesn't get who you really are. I mean, even the most basic version, if someone gets your name wrong, that really puts things on a bad... the conversation's not going well if that happens, isn't it? But isn't this a staggering thing for the Creator to say? The one who's high and lifted up, who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, to say, I want an authentic relationship with you. I value time with you. And I want you to know me, myself, for that reason. So in that conversation all those years ago, I would love to have said something like this to Mark. Being in a relationship with God, it also involves praying and spending time in his presence. And sometimes it's true, Mark, I do that out of duty. But actually the real reason I'm doing it fundamentally, and I know this in my better moments, is because I know that God genuinely enjoys it when I spend time with him. Even though he's God, and he really shouldn't enjoy my company, but he does. And that's whether I'm asking him to change things in my life or the world, whether I'm confessing, whether I'm thanking him for things, whether I'm just praising him for who he is, or even just talking to him about the mundane things in my day. I know that he values my company. And I think that's amazing. And actually, that's why he made me. Come to me, says Jesus, and I will give you rest. All right, four commandments down, six to go. How long have we got? I'm kidding. We'll do these much more quickly. So is being in relationship with God then, is it mainly just about me personally and how I correspond with God on my own? Or does it impact the rest of life? Well, we know the answer to that. Of course, it impacts the rest of life. And that's why we need to factor in commandments 5 through 10, the horizontal commandments, as you might call them. And we will cover them much more briefly. So just have a look down at them with me. So this is verse 12 through to 17. And I'll quickly paraphrase them. Honor your father and mother. Don't murder other people. Don't commit adultery with other people. Don't steal from other people. Don't lie about other people. And don't covet other people's stuff. Okay? Are you sensing a theme? It's all about how we behave and relate towards other people. And to be honest, I think the summary that Luke gave us earlier of, well, that Jesus quotes, is as good as it gets. Love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, none of us could summarize it better than that, could we? Love these people like you love yourself. So what difference does it make to know God, Mark? Everything. I mean, now I actually know how to live my whole life. And I think, can we just imagine what it might be like to live somewhere in a society that operated by these kinds of rules? That actually did operate that way, I mean. Imagine for a second a place with no adultery. Let's just take that one to start with. No adultery. What would a society with no adultery be like? How much easier would relationships be across the board? How much easier would child rearing be for so many people? Or what about no stealing? What would a world with no stealing be like? Well, you'd have no need for burglar alarms, padlocks. I mean, I could leave my bike in London against a railing without locking it up. That would be brilliant. I'd love that. And we could go on and just keep building up a picture of this society. Actually, I'll do you one better. I don't know if you know this, but over the next few chapters in Exodus, so chapter 21 to 23, you get a whole load more laws which expand the Ten Commandments, really. And that's a good place to see what society would really be like. And it shows a lot of the detail. So I thought I'd just read a couple of bits out. I think it's really beautiful. So firstly, it talks about a picture of a really fair society. It's all about compensation for when things go wrong in life. It's actually where you get the really famous verse, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. One of the most misquoted, well, quoted out of context verses in the Bible, isn't it? Let me read it to you, actually. So this is chapter 21 in verse 23 to 25. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. You know, actually, Mark often quoted that one out of context as well. It's a classic. It's a classic of atheists. But really, the point here is not to legitimize vengeance, which is what the atheist is often saying. Actually, it's saying if anything does go wrong in life, and God forbid things do go wrong, but if anything does go wrong, this kind of society will make sure that fair compensation is made. That's all it's saying. And it doesn't literally mean the other guy knocks out the first guy's tooth to, you know, so you're both without one tooth. That's not what it says when you read the rest of the context. Usually it just means give him the right amount of money to make things fair again. That's all it is. So it's a fair society. And then it goes a bit further. It starts talking about active compassion. So just listen to the start of chapter 23, just for an example. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit, siding with the many, so as to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. I love that. It's really balanced. Don't side with the many. Don't side against the poor. Don't side with the poor just because they're poor. Let's be fair. And then it gets compassionate again if you read on. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, this is your enemy's ox, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall rescue it with him. Isn't that lovely? You're doing good even to the person you don't like. That's the kind of society that the Ten Commandments are talking about, expanded here. It's a good society. It's fair. It's compassionate. It's very attractive. And you know, there's a reason why so many of the Ten Commandments are fundamentally embedded in the laws of so many different societies, whether Christian or not, all around the world. And there's a reason why they're still the basis for so much of our legal system here. It's because they're so self-evidently right and good, aren't they? I think you could even say, really, these horizontal commandments, commandments 5 to 10, are a basic description of what it means to be human. At home, when we buy something new that needs assembling, my normal instinct is to just try and put it together without the instruction manual. Just think, yeah, instinct will carry me. I'll probably get it right. Maybe Hannah would disagree if you asked her. But there are some things you really do need the designer's instructions for. These horizontal commands in the Ten Commandments, they sound an awful lot to me like the designer describing the way he made the product to be, as it were. This is how we work best. This is how we've been designed. And I think that's a point of contact with the first four commandments. Do you remember the first four commandments? God is trying to recapture this rest from the early days of creation, the thing he made us for. And now horizontally, recapturing the kind of society that he made us to be too. I mean, perhaps even these horizontal commands are, in some sense, a vision of what it actually looks like to be at rest with God. So here is Israel gathered on Mount Sinai. They're not sure what it means for them to be in relationship with God. But then God answers. He descends, he speaks to them from within the darkness and cloud. And the Ten Commandments thunder out from the mountain. So what are they left with? And what are we left with? To be God's people means this: an authentic relationship with God as he really is. Enjoying time with him in rest. As a community that functions the way that humanity was designed to be, in fairness and compassion and love. This is life as it's meant to be. Now, I said at the start, this isn't meant to be a sermon where you go away and do any one thing in particular. But I have been hoping and praying that seeing this picture of what it means to be God's people has been, to some extent, as thrilling for you as it has been for me. I've been praying that it would change the way we approach things in life, perhaps like our prayer lives, our approach to Scripture, our service of other people. And I've been praying that it would change the extent to which we look forward to and long for all of these things being finally perfected in glory. But as we finish, I know that we know the nation of Israel didn't actually live up to these commands. We know that this vision has never fully materialized on earth. Right? Well, sort of. Now, it's true that this picture won't fully materialize until we see Jesus face to face. But actually, there was a period, and I'm going to guess here, I think it was about 2 hours long, in human history, when this sort of did happen. And it's in Exodus 24. And perhaps you'd like to turn there with me. Otherwise, you won't believe it's actually in the Bible. It's brilliant, this passage. So this is just after God gave the Ten Commandments and then all of the smaller commandments that expand them. And then at the start of chapter 24, the Israelites basically say, yes, please, we would love to be in relationship with you, God, if this is what it's like. Of course they say that. And they sign a covenant at Mount Sinai to ink this in. Again, I think the marriage analogy is actually quite helpful. It's like they've signed the register at this point. But then look at what happens in verse 9 through to 11. I'm going to read this out. And as I'm reading, just think wedding reception, okay? 24 verse 9. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, that is on the mountain. And they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. What? That blows my mind, that passage. They ate and drank with God? They saw him face to face? This is, yeah, I mean, you didn't think that was in the Bible, did you? Maybe perhaps you've come across this before. A pavement of sapphire beneath the Lord's feet, not being consumed by him. I think it is fairly like a wedding feast, really. This is what it means for God to be our God. This is what it means to be in relationship with him. And it's already happened once, back in Exodus, very, very briefly, as I say, maybe about 2 hours. But it's a stunning foretaste of what we have now spiritually and will physically have when we see him face to face. They beheld God and ate and drank.